If Donald Trump is anything, he is unconventional, to put it mildly. This hour, Trump compared to other presidents at 1 year. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'm joined by presidential historian Tim Walch and political scientist Rachel Caulfield to mark 1 year of Trump in office, a look at his accomplishments and all the ways in which he's defied convention when compared with other modern presidents. In terms of relations with his own party and his staff and cabinet, in terms of alleged scandal, how he deals with criticism, and how he talks about the U.S. military and the nuclear arsenal. Join our conversation as we compare this president's first year to other presidents in history. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, if Donald Trump is anything, he is unconventional, to put it mildly. This hour, we're going to compare Donald Trump in his first year to other presidents in office in U.S. history, this 45th president. Joining us to do that, Tim Walch is a presidential historian we've had on many times to compare presidents in office in historical perspective. He's retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim, great to have you back, as always.
Good to be here, Ben.
Rachel Caulfield is with us, associate professor of political science at Drake University, one of our regular political gang on Wednesday, except it's Monday today. Rachel, welcome. Thanks for stepping into the studio.
Well, thanks for having me, except it's Tuesday.
It's Tuesday. Okay. The holiday threw me off. All right. I have to fess up to that.
She's speaking truth to power, Ben.
I am.
Can't whitewash that or spin my way out of it, so I'll just continue here. But we want to talk this hour about, first of all, the accomplishments of President Trump in comparison to other presidents, and then also the outstanding difference, the unconventionality of this president, and explore many facets, probably far too many for us to get through in the entire hour. Get to some of the major ways in which this president has broken precedent. Tim's thoughts on that, Rachel's thoughts on that, perhaps your thoughts on that as well. Join our conversation with your questions about how Donald Trump stacks up to other presidents 1 year in office. What's been accomplished? What's been unconventional? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Well, let's start with Donald Trump's assessment of himself. In one case, we know there have been many, many statements about how many accomplishments he has in whatever month of his presidency you want to talk about. This is from July of last year, of 2017, President Trump telling a rally in Youngstown, Ohio, that he can be more presidential than anyone else who has been president, with the exception of one president, President Lincoln.
It's much easier, by the way, to act presidential than what we're doing here tonight, believe me. And I said, with the exception of the late, great Abraham Lincoln, I can be more presidential than any president that's ever held this office. That I can tell you.
Okay, President Trump putting himself in historical context there in terms of ranking. Let's talk a little bit about his accomplishments in the first year. Acting presidential is a different facet of that. We'll talk about that a little bit later, what he's brought to this office and in that sort of bumpy term, being presidential. Rachel, what can this president claim as major accomplishments?
Well, I think clearly the tax reform bill has been his major legislative accomplishment, and really his only substantive legislative accomplishment in terms of policy. You know, many of his supporters will cite a lot of the regulations that have been turned back as a result of President Trump. Some of those are legislative. Some of those are executive orders. And I think the appointment of Neil Gorsuch would certainly be counted among his accomplishments by his supporters. I think the one big thing that he has done in terms of kind of reshaping policy for the long term would be his appointments to the federal judiciary more generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one that is not often talked about. He is going at a breakneck pace. Because he has a GOP Congress, more importantly, the Senate, which would okay all of these federal court, lower federal court appointments, Tim Walsh.
Absolutely. And in fact, most people are unaware of who appellate court judges are for their particular district. But it's really at the appellate level that a lot of laws is determined. So Rachel's absolutely right. That impact of those appointments, filling those vacancies, will be with us for several generations because he's appointing young federal court judges. And so that's going to make a big difference down the road.
So we have the tax overhaul, and it seems to have made Wall Street very happy. If you are investing in Wall Street, that may make you happy as well. The judicial appointments, both Gorsuch and the other lower federal court appointments, which could shape the judiciary for decades, for the rest of many of the lifetimes of people listening to this, for sure. But also, Rachel, we have the loosening of regulations, right? This is something interesting. The president criticized his predecessor for not doing things in conjunction with Congress, but acting on his own. This president has done that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so he's right now, he continues on pace to beat virtually all of our modern presidents in terms of signing executive orders. And he criticized his predecessor, Obama, for working through executive orders rather than working with Congress. But even with a unified Congress, he has found it convenient, I think, to use the executive order power. And that's been kind of a continual trend over time. Presidents oftentimes critique the use of unilateral executive authority. But of course, once they become president, they realize that unilateral executive authority is an incredibly useful thing.
Mm-hmm. These executive orders, Tim Walsh, is fairly new, isn't it? I mean, the way it's been used here?
Sure. The regulatory state, evolves really more after World War II than in any other period in our time, but maybe even after beginning with FDR. The idea that the government has a stake on behalf of the American people in the health of the nation, the quality of the food we eat, our quality of our water, and so forth. And so, depending upon your perspective, you see regulation as a good thing or an irritation and an interference. And so Donald Trump has become the deregulatory president. And quite frankly, if there's any accomplishment that his base would embrace, that 35%, it's that he is the disruptor. And that's essentially what they wanted, was somebody who would come in and be unpresidential. Now, of course, the president has said he's very presidential. But in many ways, if you try to compare him with presidents who preceded him and the measures that they've used, he's distinctly unpresidential. And that's the way a sizable percentage of that base really, really likes it.
After 1 year, we've heard this in the news many times, in the steps up to 12 months in office since the inauguration in January of 2017. But we have public opinion polls, and we're saying historic lows, Tim Walsh.
Exactly.
Far back would those opinion polls go, and what does that mean
well,
exactly?
Well, I mean, certainly after World War II, you can go back to, Carter and Nixon and so forth in terms of measuring their popularity. John F. Kennedy was at 77% in approval in 1961. So there have been measures of presidential popularity after the first year, going back quite a number of presidents.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald Trump is kind of mired in the mid-30s. But again, that's a very devoted base that does not seem to want to give up on anything based on what they hear the president having said 1 week to the next, or what group he's offended, or whatever nicknames or whatever that goes around, because they like the fact that he's that unconventional, unpresidential president.
Mm-hmm. Mired in the 30s. Is that as low as it goes, Rachel? Or we had President George W. Bush in the 20s, if I recall, at the end of his, perhaps? I'm not sure.
Yeah, There have been a couple periods in history where we've seen presidents dip down into the mid-30s, including the end of, by the end of his term, George W. Bush was down in the mid-20s. But there have been a couple other, you know, after the pardon of Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford's approvals dipped into the mid-30s. And obviously by the time that Richard Nixon left office, he was in the mid-20s as well. So it's rare to see a president this low at this point in their term, certainly. And I think over time what we see is presidents, as they come into office, their initial approval ratings have trended downward. And I think that has a lot to do with the growing political polarization and and how contested our elections have become and the rise of media within the election environment. But over time, we also see that presidents kind of uniformly, their approval ratings will drop over the course of their term of office, with the exception of big national crises. So, for example, you see George W. Bush, you know, midway through his first year in office, obviously, was September 11th. And so you see his approval ratings skyrocket.
Into the 90s or something.
Exactly, yeah. And then from that period onward in his presidency, you saw his approval ratings drop consistently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rachel's point is exactly right. That is, presidents start high after that first year. People want their president to succeed, their new president to succeed. And that first year is still something of a honeymoon. So at the end of a first year, it's typical to expect a president to be in the 70s or 80s. This is a president who's mired in the 30s. And as Rachel suggests, he's only going to go down from there based on you know, the course of his tenure.
If I'm remembering right, President Clinton would have had an initial popularity, and then the Monica Lewinsky brought him down. But then in his second term, he ascended again somewhat.
That's right. Yeah, well, go ahead, Rachel. Yeah.
Well, yeah, he came in with mid-50s approval rating, but he dipped down to about 37% by the time the Monica Lewinsky scandal was going on. But then he rebounded, and he's one of the few presidents who left office with approval ratings that were essentially unchanged from when he had started his first year in office.
Rachel Caulfield is with us of Drake University. Tim Walsh, presidential historian. We're putting this president, current President Trump, in historical perspective by marking his first year in office, but also we referred, listed his accomplishments, major ones at least, and then are looking at the way in which he parts ways with many of his predecessors. Here's one way. Let's talk about it. Criticism. We all know, can bring to mind examples of the way this president deals with criticism. Let's go back to President George W. Bush responding to criticism from a mother whose son, this happens to be U.S. Army Specialist Casey Sheehan, killed by enemy action during the Iraq War. She attracted media attention in 2005 for her extended anti-war protest. She had made a makeshift camp outside President Bush's Texas ranch. And here is Bush strolling out next to his ranch with reporters as Sheehan had held an anti-war vigil outside of the ranch in Crawford, Texas. This is 2005. Listen to the way he responds to criticism. Imagine this coming perhaps from this president currently.
You know, part of my duty as the president is to meet with those who've lost a loved one. And so, I sympathize with Mrs. Sheehan. She feels strongly about her position. She has every right in the world to say what she believes. This is America. She has a right to her position. And I've thought long and hard about her position. I've heard her position from others, which is get out of Iraq now. And it would be a mistake for the security of this country and the ability to lay the foundations for peace in the long run if we were to do so.
Okay. Bush 43, as we like to call him, outside his ranch in Crawford, Texas, responding to criticism. What do you make of that?
Well, he an extraordinarily generous person, a very thoughtful person, a well-studied person. And by comparison with the acrimony and the hostility that exists in the current environment, George W. Bush, who people criticized mightily during the time he was in office, appears more and more presidential, and of course has built stronger bonds with President Obama and President Clinton as well. And so we see former presidents of the United States, the current group, I think of five, really separating themselves from the incumbent. It'll be really interesting to see as we go down the road whether there's ever any association between President Trump and some of the other presidents, because President Trump has been so critical. I mean, in the process of elevating himself by self-declaration as the best, he's been unduly critical of many of his predecessors.
Mm-hmm. But Rachel, we knew this beforehand. This is a man that comes out of the business world, and he has attained the heights that he did in the real estate world as a reality TV star, as a building mogul thereby. When he met resistance, he would come back with 10 times the force to crush the resistance.
Yeah, and the White House, for the most part, has kind of celebrated this as just simply who he is, right? By saying, look, when he's hit, he'll hit back. And we see that time and time again. I think one of the critical things where President Trump is really distinguished from many of his predecessors is his attitude towards the press in particular and criticism that he receives in the press. It's not completely unprecedented in the sense that Nixon had a very hostile attitude towards the press. All presidents find a free press to be a frustrating thing when they want to get their message out. And, you know, how you choose to deal with that becomes incredibly important. I think the strongest kind of juxtaposition here is perhaps Ronald Reagan's reaction to criticism. Reagan was absolutely expert at using humor to diffuse criticism or conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of those contrasts, when you look back at some of Reagan's responses, are really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Eisenhower could mangle the language almost on purpose to come up with a confusing response, and John F. Kennedy as well was good at using humor, and Rachel's absolutely right. Presidents find a way to cope with the press and the questions that they have to ask. In fact, going as far back certainly as even President Hoover, Hoover used to argue that he wanted a federal law that allowed him to kill one member of the press each year. So, you know, it was joking, of course.
This president, and also criticized for it by his own party member, GOP Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona this weekend, criticizing this president's treatment of the press as Stalin-like, because he used the phrase enemy of the people. This is attacking the so-called Fourth Estate, Rachel, what is really built into our Constitution as a safeguard.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the unique things about the Trump presidency, when we look back on this period in time, I think what we will note is that the media landscape has changed so profoundly. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump, in many ways, I mean, he will be our first social media president. So he doesn't need the mainstream press in the way that former presidents have needed the mainstream press, which allows that antagonistic relationship to move to the next level, because he can move around established reporters and press outlets that for years and years and years have been absolutely essential in mediating the relationship between the president and the voters.
Right. And Rachel, does this have something to do with his bare-knuckle approach to criticism, also bare-knuckle approach to anybody who voices criticism opponents here? I mean, because that is our new media environment out there, Rachel, right? Because mm-hmm. you've got so many trolls out there throwing all kinds of things out there that you wouldn't want to mention on these airwaves, the president included, right?
Sometimes.
So you're saying he's a creature of this new media environment.
I think he is. I mean, when we go back, we can look at FDR as kind of a unique president in being the first to really use the medium of radio to communicate effectively with the American people. And he was able to create a new environment, a new relationship between himself and voters. Similarly, JFK in the age of television, he was kind of our first TV president. Donald Trump is our first Twitter president. And the role of the press, therefore, changes. You know, if you go back to the Nixon tapes, Nixon said repeatedly, the press is the enemy. But he did it behind closed doors with his advisors. We learn about it now. He was hostile towards the press. He had a tough relationship with the press. But that language of the press is the enemy is not something we heard publicly at the time. Now we're hearing it very publicly because Donald mm-hmm. Trump can take to Twitter and can use this sort of language, can reinforce relationships with his base of voters by doing so and get around the mainstream press.
His antagonism towards the press, one thing he has in common with Nixon, but also a scandal. This scandal, alleged scandal, has not played out. It's being investigated. Three investigations, one in the Senate, one in the House, one by a special counsel about the 2016 election, possible collusion, possible obstruction of justice being investigated here. We've devoted time also with you, Tim, in other instances where presidents have been besieged by alleged scandal or, in fact, scandal, as it turned out.
Absolutely. And, of course, as I'm sure Rachel would agree, that it's often, as they say, the cover-up, not so much the crime, and that the president always wants to manage his crisis. And often they make it worse. And, of course, as the first social media president, Donald Trump has misused or at least probably given in to his own predilections to counterpunch. And that's ultimately hurt him. And he's kind of been his own worst enemy in the process of using social media. So he's got this great social media platform, but he seems to be hurting himself almost on a daily or weekly basis.
Let's go back in this look at history and presidential likes and unlike comparison to this present president. Here's Richard Nixon speaking to the American people the day before he resigned and left the White House in 1973.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad. To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
What a moment that was for everyone who was alive with that in their memory. Tim Walsh, we've got to go away in just for just a few minutes. Tim and Rachel will be back in just a moment. I want to talk. I know you've got a lot of points to deal with, too, but let's also talk about candor, the relationship of this president with the truth, how that differs from previous presidents. Also, how this president talks about the power of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Here's a little bit of trivia before we go away. Perhaps you can answer it before we come back. Go back to 1984. President Ronald Reagan was getting ready for a national radio address, and he makes a joke that reverberates around the world and is not funny. And remember what that joke was? We'll talk about that in just a minute. Tim Walsh is with us, presidential historian, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, Rachel Caulfield, associate professor of political science at Drake University. We're marking 1 year of the Trump presidency by looking at how this president has broken precedent with his predecessors. We hope you'll join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Ben Kiefer back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world,
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, reaching back historically with Tim Walsh, presidential historian, and Rachel Caulfield, a political scientist at Drake University, to mark this president's 1 year in office, first year in office, and looking at the ways, mostly this hour, with how he has broken with convention, be it with conventions of Republicans and Democratic presidents. It really has less to do with partisan ideology, if I'm just thinking of this off the top of my head, Tim, then the way a president behaves?
Yeah, a lot of it is temperament and its tone and its style. There's a certain way of approaching a position that we have an expectation of the presidency, and Donald Trump has essentially defied those. He's been essentially Donald Trump rather than necessarily President Trump.
Rachel, can you think of, I mean, this president stands out as having a cabinet or staff that have exited as fast as they've come in the door, it seems. I think we're up to over 20 in his administration who have left just in the first year. I don't know if you've been keeping count of those who have left, resigned, or been fired in the first year. This has to be something that's unique.
Well, it is in the sense that he has had more turnover in his cabinet than most presidents have in their first year in office. And you have to go back to 1977 to find a cabinet that has been this unstable in the first year of a president's term. Having said that, White House staff changes are not entirely abnormal. Mm-hmm. Those who work inside the White House itself, they are directly responsible to the president. Presidents often use staff shakeups as a way to signal changes in policy direction or displeasure with the actions of a single advisor. So you do often see, particularly early in a president's term, you often see turnover within the president's inner staff. Right. And a couple people have looked at, aside from cabinet turnover, other White House staff turnover, and they've kind of come up with, this doesn't seem entirely abnormal, at least not yet.
Mm-hmm. But this is also a very leaky administration.
Indeed.
When we talk about the staff. So, Tim, talk to that point. We seem to have how many anonymous sources in the Washington Post, New York Times, and wherever?
There seems to be no end to the interest and appetite the American people have for books about the inside of any presidential administration. And, of course, as you get through the first year, there seems to be more and more of those books. They go back, by the way, in time to Emmett Hughes's book on the Eisenhower administration. So being there as a kind of a fly on the wall in the Oval Office is popular. But you're absolutely right. The number of people who are willing to talk to the press anonymously and really to settle scores with other staffers really turns this into an extraordinary soap opera. And then, of course, once the book gets published, the president has become the greatest book agent for fire and fury that one could ever imagine.
And listen to this remarkable comment here after Steve Bannon was fired. Steve Bannon, this is from the president. Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. Further down in the comment, it is the only thing he does well, pretends to be at war with the media. Steve was rarely in a one-on-one meeting with me and only pretends to have had influence to fool a few people with no access and no clue whom he helped write phony books. So this is a president that demands loyalty, demanded it from the FBI director he fired, yet doesn't get it from his staff, Rachel.
Yeah, and I think, one of the ways that Donald Trump is unique is obviously that he has a very unconventional background, very little experience in the ways of Washington. But one of the other ways that he is unique, while the turnover in the White House may not be particularly unique, at least at this stage, what is unique is that, first of all, a lot of staff positions in the executive branch have remained open and simply not been filled. And second of all, that the people working inside the White House don't have a lot of experience in the ways of Washington. And so we have a particularly kind of unfamiliar group of characters surrounding the president who are not only not necessarily familiar with the workings of the White House, but not necessarily familiar with the workings of Congress or the press or, you know, kind of the conventions that we are accustomed to.
Mm-hmm. Let's go quickly to the phones. The hour is getting away from us. We have still many points to gather into our basket as we look at the unconventional nature of this president marking his first year in office. Scott is with us in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the program. What do you want to chip in?
Thank you. I just wanted to state that it seems to me that Donald Trump just lacks the filter that most, I guess, polite society would have, where you don't say what you think all the time. And so he says what he thinks, even though maybe sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad. But I would say that that's probably what won him the presidency, was a lot of
right.
people were...
It was endearing. Yeah, his base loves that of him.
Absolutely, and that's the whole notion of the disruptor. He was going to Washington to not do things the way other presidents before him had done. And Scott's absolutely right. There is a strong percentage of people, maybe a third of the nation, who says, right on, Mr. President.
Mm-hmm. Closely related to this, every president spins the facts to fit his or her agenda on any day in any press briefing. That's what your press secretary does, the best possible lights on the situation in the day and the actions of the president. But here we have perhaps a huge leap in a different way. Let me just read from the New York Times attempting to comprehensively catalog the falsehoods of Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Now, quoting the New York Times in this article from December, it applied the same conservative standard to Obama and Trump, counting only demonstrably and substantially false statements. The result, Trump is unlike any other modern president. He seems virtually indifferent to reality, the New York Times writes, often saying whatever helps him make the case he's trying to make. In the first 10 months in office, here's where we get to the data. In the first 10 months of the office, according to the New York Times, he told 103 separate untruths, many of them repeatedly. Obama told 18 over his entire eight-year tenure. That's an average of about two a year for Obama, about 124 a year for Trump, Rachel. You've looked into this, I'm sure.
Yes. This is.
We're on a different scale.
We're on a different scale entirely. And, you know, these are the kinds of things, given the background that Donald Trump brings to the presidency, he is brash and he says what he has to say to get things done. And he's never been in a position where people are tracking whether or not he is saying things that are demonstrably false.
He's always been in a position where he creates his reality.
Right.
Yes. Sure.
Right. And he no longer is. You know, particularly in a fragmented media environment where he can speak directly to his base, it creates an entirely new set of norms around this president as compared to past presidents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say that it goes back to the days when he worked with Tony Schwartz on The Art of the Deal, maybe before that, the whole notion of truthful hyperbole and eliminating the first 10 floors of Trump Tower because he said nobody wants to live on floors 1 through 10, so we'll start with floor 11. And as far as he was concerned, that was true. And so many of the things he says about himself, I think he truly believes. Mm-hmm. And he gets angry when people outside of his own orbit or his bubble don't agree with him.
Okay, let's talk about one other facet here having to do with our nuclear assets here, our arsenal, the U.S. Since the end of World War II under Harry Truman, we live in an atomic age. And presidents since then, almost, what, a dozen presidents since then have talked about mm-hmm. it in a certain way. This president breaks again with convention. Before we talk about that, let's talk about this instance, which demonstrates something about how sensitive this is, and rightly so. In August of 1984, President Ronald Reagan, while running for re-election, was preparing to make his weekly Saturday national radio address. During a sound check before the address, Reagan made this joke to radio technicians.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Okay, Tim Walz, your face is lit up. You remember that
There's
well.
A
I
trademark
too.
Reagan wit.
It was. But and the truth is, you could almost hear a little bit of the smile or the laughter in his voice. And of course, but it was shocking to the American people to hear a president of the United States in that distinctive voice saying words like that. Mm-hmm. But over the past year, we've heard many phrases and comments unexpected.
Let's listen to the past year with the threat of nuclear war. Growing, Donald Trump warning North Korea in August of last year that he would unleash fire and fury upon the country if future threats were issued.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening. Beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Little did anyone know then that that would be taken as a book title, a very important book title. Rachel, comment on the way this president, I'll just say, throws around very harsh rhetoric, threats with our nuclear arsenal.
Well, I think there are a couple different factors here. The first is, as our caller suggested, Donald Trump doesn't use the conventional filters that we're accustomed to hearing from presidents. I mean, even in Ronald Reagan's joking about the use of nuclear weapons, there was a presidential tone and tenor to the way that he said that. And Donald Trump has never had that tone and tenor, that gravity. To his words. Second of all, I think that, you know, as somebody who's not familiar with the ways of Washington, he oftentimes speaks without fully vetting his statements, particularly in foreign policy and particularly when you're talking about nuclear power. Previous presidents have, for good reason, very carefully vetted their language with diplomats and State Department employees and Defense Department employees and advisors and members of Congress have really worked to craft that language. And then the third factor that comes into play here is the current media environment. With information and statements being transmitted as quickly as they are today, an unvetted statement by Donald Trump goes out immediately, and it receives immediate response. And he's, I think, very comfortable with the immediacy of that communication technology, and I think others are not. And so it breaks with tradition in a lot of important ways.
Absolutely, what Rachel is saying is dead on. The other thing that compounds the problem in our relationship with foreign nations is the fact that so many of our positions at the assistant secretary level and our ambassadorial appointments are vacant. And so consular officers at lower levels are being called in by government saying, what does your president mean when he says something about African nations or he says something about North Korea? I mean, there's great concern because, quite frankly, we are still the world's leader when it comes to world peace. And so all words have consequences and all tweets have consequences. And it's presented a real problem for the State Department.
Looking at ways in which this president is much different than previous presidents, regardless of political party. Finishing up our hour with Tim Walz, presidential historian, Rachel Caulfield, political scientist from Drake University. A couple of other points I want to make sure we get to. Fire and Fury, the book, reignited the debate that's been brought up several times about this president's mental fitness for office, his description of himself as a very stable genius, besides being used as a meme and on T-shirts or wherever you want to see across the country. It sparked a new debate about the 25th Amendment. This is the provision that to remove a president from office that dates back to Kennedy's era.
Well, it actually goes back as far as, quite frankly, even back to Woodrow Wilson, when Wilson was incapacitated in the last 2 years or so of his presidency, and he was restricted. In fact, all access to him was through his wife, Edith, and there were those who whispered that she was acting as Mrs. President. But then when Dwight Eisenhower had a heart attack and then later a stroke, the question was, should we be transferring power to the vice president temporarily? Mm-hmm. And so the 25th Amendment was essentially set up to articulate a temporary transfer of power as a result of a medical disability. It never really spoke to the whole question of mental disability. So it's physical disability. It does, in Article 4, articulate a potential transfer of power if a majority of the cabinet with the vice president agree that the president needs to step down temporarily. But then the president can oppose this and go to the Congress. I think the House of Representatives needs actually two-thirds of both houses. Mm-hmm. So it's so cumbersome. And it would have to be almost to the point where a president was absolutely delusional or making no sense or somehow completely incapacitated from reality.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just not viable as far as I can mm-hmm. see.
Do you read it the same way, Rachel?
I do, and I think that's for good reason, right, to protect against the possibility of a coup.
right.
So institutionally, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think today's conversation, a lot of people are saying, gosh, we're having this conversation about the mental fitness of a president. We've had these conversations in the past. Again, they've been quieter oftentimes, but advisors to Ronald Reagan noted a decline in his ability to remember key details of meetings and even in his ability to pay attention during meetings. Many of his advisors, after the fact, reported that he was increasingly, retreating to the residence to watch movies and TV. And his own son, in his book, noted that he saw signs of mental deterioration about the third year into Reagan's presidency. Of course, later it was revealed that he had Alzheimer's. We've had presidents who have been taking psychiatric and psychotropic drugs while in office. There are accounts that aides to Johnson actually consulted with psychiatrists during 1965 and 1966 in the height of the Vietnam War. So the stress of the job has always, I think, created a unique environment, and it's difficult for, I think, anybody to maintain the level of activity and mental acuity that's required to perform the job effectively. And so, part of this is personality. Part of this is the demands of the job.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish up in our final 5 minutes. Make sure we get this in. Central to the American identity is immigration, the idea that we are a land of immigrants. Let's go back to a previous president you just mentioned. Again, he's been featured prominently in this hour. President Reagan in 1986 signing the Immigration Reform and Control Act. This is the first major revision of America's immigration laws in decades. At that time, it included amnesty. That's a word that's been used many times since. It's an amnesty provision. Here's Reagan speaking about the need for immigration reform back in 1984 during presidential debates.
I'm going to do everything I can, and all of us in the administration are, to join in again when Congress is back at it to get an immigration bill that will give us once again control of our borders. And with regard to friendship below the border and with the countries down there, yes, no administration that I know has established the relationship that we have with our Latin friends. But as long as they have an economy that leaves so many people in dire poverty and unemployment, they are going to seek that employment across our borders, and we work with those other countries.
Okay. Conservative Ronald Reagan, yeah. Republican Ronald Reagan, contrast that with Republican Donald Trump growing frustrated with lawmakers last week when they discussed protecting immigrants from Haiti, El Salvador, African countries as part of a bipartisan immigration deal. According to several people briefed on the meeting, I don't think there's really any question about this. When you look at the credibility of the people saying, the president saying, why are we having all these people from shithole countries come here? So, Rachel, take this up. This is central to the American identity, as I mentioned, a land of immigrants. We certainly have a contrast here.
It is. It's, You know, this has been one of our most enduring policy debates, I think, in terms of defining who we are as a country relative to our neighbors and relative to other portions of the world. What responsibilities do we have? And yet, at the same time, how do we interpret our own sovereignty and the need for border security? You know, various presidents have tried to address the issue of immigration in a comprehensive way, and they have failed. Right. And so in that sense, what we're seeing right now in Washington is kind of a continuation of a theme. I do think there's been a lot of conversation in the past week about the very specific comments and words that the president used. And if you go back and listen to virtually any previous president, the language that's used inside the West Wing, this is not new. This is not different.
Right.
And so the fact that we have a more public environment where people are more willing to talk about it and news spreads as quickly as it does, you know, that might be different. But
The final word to Tim, I just wanted to follow up here. The president on immigration, this within the last few hours after meeting with the president of Kazakhstan, President Trump responding to a reporter's question about immigration, saying, "I want them to come from everywhere, everywhere."
Yeah,
your historical context comment on the president and his take on immigration, have we seen this before?
Yeah, well, always. On the one hand, we want to be restrictive. On the other hand, we want to be open. We want to be, you know, transparent, but we want to control. So at the end of the day, going back to 1924 when we restricted immigration, and then again in 1965 when we opened it up in 86, it is a continuing theme. But one of the things I think we should take as hopeful is we replenish ourselves when we allow and bring people in. And it's a great reflection on the country we have that so many people want to come here. And these are people of ambition and drive and determination and education.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rachel and Tim, I hope we didn't leave any big points off your list. We had far too many departures from the path that this president has taken to get into 1 hour, Rachel.
Yes.
Well, Ben, we have to do something called Trumpapalooza, I think. You know, just a whole week of Trump shows.
Tim Walsh, presidential historian, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, stepping into our studio in Iowa City. Thank you so much, Tim.
Glad to be with you, Ben.
And Rachel Caulfield, associate professor of political science at Drake University. Rachel, thanks for coming into our Des Moines studio.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Politics Day already tomorrow. See, it's Tuesday. I know, Tim, it's Tuesday. We'll see you then tomorrow, Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.